Good evening and welcome to the first in a series of three evening forums. My name is Mark Twain, the village philosopher, who also appears in various other sundry roles from time to time. This evening we're here to honor a historical tradition and to sort of renew and continue a process of inquiry that began some 450 odd years ago. Had you been in one of Luther's classes at Wittenberg in the early 16th century, you would have discovered that one of the principal means of pedagogy that he used was to formulate a thesis, hand a copy of that thesis to two of his students who would take up positions on various behind various podiums, to his right and to his left, such as those that you see here, and then take positions over and against the thesis in order to clarify what was at issue, to sharpen points of controversy, and to take positions vis-a-vis the thesis that was put forward. That's the format we're going to use tonight. And I just want you to understand that it's a format which has that same aim, that is to clarify and extend a thesis, one that you saw posted today on this door and on the tree. The thesis, which I will read to you once more before giving a copy to each of my students here, Brother Larry Rasmussen and Brother Bruce Birch, is as follows. A church of material comfort will not go to the cross. I've asked these students to each prepare a 3 to 5 minute. Don't want to give them any loopholes. A 3 to 5 minute presentation. And I think you should understand that the positions they'll be representing need not necessarily represent views that are genuinely their own. And that will apply all week long. The persons making the opening statements are doing so for the purposes I said earlier, not to seriously represent positions that are theirs, though of course they may happen indeed to be theirs, but it's not necessarily theirs. Once they're finished, they will leave, disrobe, join the rest of us, who will then, I hope...
disrobe.
That's right. I hadn't thought of that aspect. Did I say disrobe? I guess I did. I don't think that was in the plans. Maybe if things get boring by Wednesday night, we'll use that gambit. For tonight, they will simply
resume. Arguments may appear barren.
That's right. All right, at any rate, they will return, and we will continue the disputation, discussion, exploration among ourselves. So I shall give each of them a copy of the thesis, and I believe that Brother Birch will go first. Brother Birch.
In upholding this thesis tonight, I was tempted to simply replay John Schramm's sermon from last night. Nevertheless, I will uphold the position that this statement is true. A church of material comfort will not go to the cross. I will hold that it is true biblically, historically, and in our present experience of the church. Biblically, the way of the cross is the way of the servant, foreshadowed in 2 Isaiah and fulfilled by Jesus Christ. That role of the servant is a willingness, entails a willingness to give up all for the sake of God's kingdom, for the sake of the mission of justice and reconciliation. And that role of the servant entails suffering and pain and not comfort. Riches are described in the Bible as a barrier. The sharing of resources and the community of Israel in the wilderness gave way eventually to class disparities in the richness of the land. Fullness of life, as it was promised by God to Israel, clearly implied sufficiency for all, but the prophets were eventually forced to condemn the luxury of some side by side with the poverty of others. Jesus' sayings on the difficulty of material possessions are well known. The way of the cross often demands giving those material possessions up. It is clear biblically that material comfort does not prevent good works. For example, the rich young ruler did good works. But they do prevent the total commitment demanded by the way of the cross. And therefore, the rich young ruler was turned away from discipleship because of his unwillingness to part with his material possessions. Historically, those who have taken up the cross have been those willing to give all for the sake of God's kingdom, following Christ's example. And of course, there have been those from settings of comfort who took up the cross, but only after giving up their privileged position, such as Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Historically, as Douglas John Hall and others have seen, the more established and prosperous churches have become in the North American setting, the less has been heard of a theology of the cross. Indeed, material success is often confused in this cultural setting with the signs of God's special favor to America. President Ford, speaking on the occasion of the bicentennial, said, "This nation is great because it is good. Should it cease to be good, she would cease to be great." This theology of success is not the theology of the cross. I believe that in our own present experience as the church, the greatest conflict arises when any congregation is asked to risk its material possessions for the sake of its mission. "Let's have a hot lunch program for the elderly instead of the poor. They tear up the building less." Churches of material comfort seldom choose paths of mission that involve serious economic risk, ostracism in the community, loss of membership, or risk of damage to their property. But all of these things may be demanded by the way of the cross. This is not to say that these congregations may not do some good works, but their giving is from their excess and not from basic sacrifices of other material priorities. Risk is for the radical, not basic to the definition of the church in such congregations. I close simply with one final word. Would Christ recognize as the way of the cross a system in which the richest churches can buy what they consider to be the best pastors, while poor churches often go for long periods without adequate pastoral leadership? Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Birch. Brother Rasmus.
I wondered, as I looked at those two Coke glasses, if that's what Luther students received as reward. One is tempted to use old debaters' tricks and use ad hominem remarks about my debating. Now, a colleague here, if you've noted Brother Birch in the dining hall, you will know he has not kept his vow of celibacy. Precious message. The thesis is that the church of material comfort will not approach the cross. In the book by Langdon Gilkey, Shantung Compound, he tells of the experience of being detained in China by the Japanese during World War II. He was in a camp in which the Japanese stood guard, but let the inmates set up what was in fact human society in microcosm. And Gilkey talks in that book of the great change that took place in human behavior that came when material comfort became material discomfort. Just a couple small examples. All generosity and hospitality was lost when there wasn't an extra room for a guest. Everyone had to sleep in the same room. It was fine to be generous, and people were generous with their foods, until that time came when all of them ate and they were still hungry. There was an obsession in the under the conditions of material discomfort with self and with clan, greed and covetousness, and all of the vices that Paul lists as opposite the fruits of the Spirit came to predominate. So it was not only that under the conditions of material discomfort, people did not go to the cross, that is to say, they did not stand in solidarity with the suffering, and that they did not exhibit self-sacrifice, but they ended up, in effect, if you will, crucifying one another. Or one thinks of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, in which he demonstrates that there are some basic human needs, such as food, clothing, shelter, minimal material comfort, if you will, that must be met before the humanly enhancing behavior is possible, before there is exhibited the fruits of the Spirit. So until there is a kind of minimal material comfort, what we would call the Christian virtues do not arise. Another way of saying that is that poverty kills the soul as well as the body. It warps the psyche as well as the corpus. It breeds injustice. It breeds violence. It breeds self-absorption. So I want to say two things. First, the church of material discomfort will not go to the cross. And secondly, a church of material comfort just might. And that's what I want to speak to. I have no interest whatsoever in defending unbounded American affluence and access as either deserved or as evidence of God's blessing. I have no desire to give Christian sanction to that, and that's not what the thesis is about in my judgment. But rejecting that picture of material comfort, I will contend that a church of material comfort might go to the cross if it's faithful. What does it mean to be faithful? I have to argue against Brother Birch on biblical grounds here. Biblically, poverty is a dehumanizing condition to be eradicated. It's something to be delivered from. It's the enemy of faithful living. And so the covenant, if one was faithful, poverty was not present, or the Acts community. Give to those as they all have need. And the kingdom of God biblically is pictured in images of material comfort and abundance, banquets and fine raiment, and the New Jerusalem with streets of gold and no human suffering and no human sorrow and no human want. The image of the kingdom of God is one of material comfort. Or historically, the great figures in the community of faith have been those which have come from the ranks of the materially blessed and the materially privileged. They have joined others in acts of deliverance of those in material discomfort and those who are caught in the violence of poverty. So one thinks of Moses. It's hard to imagine the leadership that Moses might have had without having been reared in Pharaoh's court. One thinks of Joseph before Moses, Secretary of Agriculture in Egypt. One thinks of Augustine. Yes, he gave up that wealth, but his great gifts to the church, leadership, theology, all came from the fact that he was reared in privileged circles and could pass along his gifts because those were his circumstances. Even a St. Francis, who joined the poor, took with him the kind of gifts that come from not having to spend one's life fighting for survival. Luther's talk is peasant talk. But in fact, his father was a rather high-class peasant, and Luther was an educated man, and not a hungry one, if you've ever seen any pictures. John Calvin was a lawyer, a humanist. Brother Birch mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Again, there is no way of understanding Bonhoeffer's gifts to the church without understanding that circle of privilege and material comfort in which he was reared. Martin Luther King, if you've been to Ebenezer Baptist Church, it's a very large church in Atlanta, Georgia. And Martin Luther King came from two generations of black clergy, professional middle class blacks. Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King were two people that went to the cross and out of a church of material comfort. Think of Latin American leadership today, Camilo Torres, a professor, Gustavo Gutierrez, theologian. Solidarity with the poor, but from the ranks of the materially blessed. Sonia Johnson among the Mormons, virtually all the feminist leadership in the church today from the same ranks. So I conclude, one, that a church of utter material need will not go to the cross because of the violence of poverty and the self-absorption of survival. And two, a church of material comfort might go to the cross if it's faithful, has done so on occasions, and will do so again.
Thank you very much. Thank you both.
This is a serious day.
What do you mean?
Well, it's now time to hear from the rest of you, and the rest of you to hear from each other, so who'd like to speak first? I institute a rule here that anyone who is speaking may speak for as long as they please, so long as there's not another hand up. As soon as I see another hand, that person's notified that they have 30 seconds. And sometimes I don't notice you if you're up here behind the hood in the back, so you're licensed to shout meekly until I catch your attention. And that goes for people along the sides, too. Sometimes I just forget to look up. So, a church of material comfort will not go to the cross. Yes.
It seems the issue that we're talking about it revolves around two definitions: what is material culture and what is going to the cross. So I think to pursue the topic means we really need to identify, is there a continuum of material culture that we fit on someplace, or that America sits at one end of and people living in Asia sit some other place on that? And is that a significant factor in their dealings with their dedication to what they believe? Is it convenient? Does it fit in? Is it another piece of hardware to put on the shelf? My cross goes next to my stereo and my popcorn popper. Or does it sit next to my scythe that I cut up my rice with?
I will simply stipulate, I rarely respond directly, but I would stipulate that on the material comfort issue, lest we get caught up in definitions, I would simply stipulate that I think what the thesis intends is that the Church of Material Comfort means to be a description of the churches that 90% of those of us sitting here come from. I mean, there may be some who do not, but just generally our own collective experience is pretty much represented by material comfort. As far as going to the cross, that's more difficult, but I think that both speakers had in mind, regardless of their positions, something like being faithful to Jesus Christ, going to the cross, was another way of saying being faithful to Jesus Christ. Others of you are free to amplify or expand that notion, or respond to those questions. But I think that's the issue, yes.
I think maybe another definition, though, is important, and that is the church. I found, in a sense, both respondents avoiding the question by giving examples of individuals, not by giving examples of the church. it may be true that Bonhoeffer gave up everything that he had, which would demonstrate one point, and he came from an affluent background, which would demonstrate another point. But in neither case is he an example of the church during the Nazi regime. So I'm not quite sure whether, when you talk about your thesis, whether you want to talk about the body of Christ, or whether you are allowing a respondent to demonstrate his or her approach to that thesis by using individual members of that body of Christ.
Okay. Responses to that? Help on what is the church or what this... Yes.
To help along that line of clarification, as a layman, I was offended by the first brother speaking and closing his whole presentation with an example of the great church, by definition, has a great pastor, and poor church has nothing. Is that the definition of a church we want to deal with? Whether or not a congregation has a good pastor, is rich and has a good pastor, or poor and none at all? Is that the church? Perhaps from a clergy point of view, but not from a laity.
Responses to that? Helps clarify the business about a church. Notice that Jesus said a church. Not the church of material comfort. A church of material comfort will not go to the cross. Yeah.
I think one way we can look at this is to talk about individual congregations, because each of us usually has most interaction with an individual congregation. And to speak about a larger group than just that, how that congregation looks at something, is sometimes kind of divorcing ourselves from the situation.
If we were to look at an individual congregation as what we mean by a church, a kind of organization located at a certain corner of two streets, a certain suburb, or wherever, do you want to support the thesis or just suggest that as a definition?
I suggest as a definition. I can think of my own congregation I'm a member of, and think of things that we've done that I believe would be supportive, and at the same time other things that I can think of that are not supportive.
Other responses from congregational experiences?
Yes, I just can't think of a congregation going to the cross. As a congregation, I just frankly cannot see a congregation going to the cross. That just, you know, I'm too pictorial a person. I'm trying to image that, and I can't make one up.
Okay.
So I think a way a congregation can go to the cross or not go to the cross is how it chooses to spend its money. A congregation may choose to hire another staff person so that you can have a bigger music program, or it could choose to hire, instead of hiring that person, to get involved in feeding the poor. Our own congregation is located in the area of Albuquerque, that we get many transients. We're right off of the main highway through there. Our church office gets requests for food on very many times a day, I would believe. And certainly we're in an opportune position where we could choose to spend money by having essentially a soup kitchen.
Yeah, I think it's rich. I can't see. I'd like to respond to the question about imaging a church going to the cross. Let's suppose instead of faithfulness to Jesus Christ, which is not specific enough to clarify the debate for me, let's use language of Jesus, lose your life in order to find it. Some individuals have done that, and Brother Rasmussen spoke to them. Let's say the thesis is a congregation that now is materially wealthy or comfortable, will it lose its life in order to find it? Corporately. That, I think, I would say that historically I don't see evidence of it, and I'd agree with Brother Birch. I don't see evidence of that happening. institutional self-preservation becomes very strong. And at that point, it seems to me, we're into the question of the church being frustrated that individual Christians do not risk or lose their life in order to find it, when the whole message, institutionally or corporately, wouldn't give that kind of message, because the church itself won't do it. If we think in terms of going out of business institutionally for your faithfulness, that is my image of the church going to the cross. And I don't think a materially comfortable or wealthy one will do it.
In some respects, the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America has done just that, though, in the movement in the past couple of decades, labeled liberation theology. Traditionally, the institutional church was on the side of the wealthy and those who had more than they needed. And these very same congregations and churches, which had once sided with the status quo and those who held the strings to power and money, began to see the situation differently. And many of the priests and nuns and laity in Latin America have given up literally wealth, and bishops have given up bishops' palaces. Happened in Spokane with the Roman Catholic bishop too. It seems that a church that has material comfort has not yet been to the cross. But it doesn't seem like that outlaws or necessarily defies that they might not be smacked by the living word and see that that is the path of the cross and the way to discipleship.
Yes.
I'm trying to double check what I'm hearing. So the parishes in Latin America which have chosen to support a liberation theology, then you say, are in effect cutting themselves off from the mother church, which is tied financially really seriously and heavily to industrialized multinational corporations in Europe?
There are certain parishes and certain church leaders who have, well, for example, Oscar Romero, who was assassinated in March, stopped the building project on the cathedral where he held mass, because the local people didn't have enough to eat. He refused to put any more funds into the completion of the building.
So what you're saying then is that we can take that as a definition that would help us deal with this thesis. They are no longer a part of the world mother church. They are a church going to the cross.
They still feel themselves to be within the Catholic Roman family. And they are calling those parishes and congregations who are still siding with those who have more than they need to join them in giving up, just as Jesus asked the rich young ruler to join him by selling what he had and joining the poor. In a similar respect, what I hear many liberation theologians saying is the faithful thing to do in the Latin American situation.
Well, that intrigues me, because I'm only becoming aware of the Vatican political structure. But I do see parallels in that kind of an administrative organization with the Lutheran structures in this country or in the world. Are we, as individual congregations, then in order to go to the cross, is it demanded of us that we remove ourselves from the strictures of such an administration and likewise the benefits and support, such as training of the priests or ministers, whether Catholic or Lutheran? I think the thesis is so broad, or so general, as it stands, and we get into some of these areas, such as the example from Latin America, I neither can apply it to my position as a Christian or to my participation in my church as a Lutheran.
How about an example of congregations I've known of them who decided to put out a large amount of money to install a pipe organ in their church, where maybe they were located in a place where there were a lot of transients nearby, and they saw the priority of their spending into buying an organ so that they could have a better sounding instrument rather than meeting the basic human needs of the community of folks who live around the building.
Okay, that gets a little closer for me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just finished working at a church where it was really important that every single door was locked all day long, and I had to go around and meet a staff person with my pocket of keys, and that just irritated me because I just felt that we weren't living up to the gospel. That's not what God called us to do, to build a building that we had to constantly have our keys to lock up against the world. And I was constantly asking them, what are we doing in this community? And so that's, I just think that I want to support what Marilyn was saying, that Christians aren't called to build beautiful churches. I think we're called to minister to the people that are in the midst.
I'm not disagreeing.
No, I'm just supporting them.
Yes.
Could I, for my own opinion, amplify then your definition of a material church? How about then those of us who belong to churches, and I think this has got to be worldwide, where very often you will have a church which is more than willing to donate money, but the time is something you just can't get. And to me, that's probably a harder sacrifice than the money is. And for myself now, I have to include in this material church, this material comfort, those of us who have structured time, and I think all of us do that, but I think those of us who can only give so much time, or those who aren't willing to give or sacrifice some of their own personal time. You know, such as, am I going to do my garden, or am I going to do something for Jesus?
I thought would clarify the issue for me would be a congregation that was in a community where the almost the total economy of that community was defense contracts, and that congregation, a lot of the budget of that church depended on people that work for defense contractors. The minister's salary would be dependent on that. And this church had a vision of the insanity of the arms race. Made a stand, lost half of its members, and the pastor had to cut his salary in half. We might be getting in our nation close to the cost. It's also a definition of my congregation.
It's also what?
Somewhat of the definition of my congregation.
Oh, of your own, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
The bottom line in the business is survival. The bottom line in politics is being elected. Is the bottom line in the theses a church that dies? Did his make it because only half of it died?
Someone like to respond? Well, I would say that the bottom line cannot be survival. That is, in other words, it's not as though the church is there principally for the sake of its own survival.
The artist mentioned that he felt he had never seen an example of a church then that did in that dimension dying. Is there no one here who has ever heard of a church dying in that role?
Yes.
I don't want to respond to that directly, but I wish I had a better memory so I could remember the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, but it's something in the end about it's in dying that we might have life.
It's in the front of the hymnal. I think you quoted it.
Did that ever, incidentally, Rich, answer to the suggestions of the various people who have responded to what they take an image of a church going to the cross to look like? Either images that have been drawn from their experience or images that they've put forward. Has that filled it out sufficiently for you? Or?
Oh, it's it's filled it up so that I'm just ready to bust. I mean, I'm a stained glass window designer, don't you know? And whoever said that we were not called to build beautiful churches has hit me in the gut. Because I have been, and I think one of the greatest idolatries is the sin against the admonition of Paul that says, whatsoever things are beautiful, think on these things. I think we can get as far away from the cross worshiping on a pile of manure as we can worshiping in a cathedral. I'm not saying that the cathedral or the manure is the thing that's going to lead us to the cross, but I am saying that there are appropriate spaces that will point out what the function of the believers is and direct their attention to that.
Yes, sir.
I came in just after that comment was made, so I didn't want to just jump in with what I had to say, but now's an appropriate time. I was at a lecture once where the teacher was talking about some of the great cathedrals of the world and how the beauty of them draws our attention to God as holy, and how often in America we tend to see God as a pal or something, whereas the really beautiful churches give a great sense of worship. And afterwards I went up and said, yeah, I really follow what you're saying, but isn't it more important to feed people and to care for the oppressed? And he said, well, for these churches, these early churches, it wasn't an either or. They gave enough of their resources for both.
Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi led his church on a way of tremendous poverty, but it wasn't to the cross. There has got to be something other than poverty or other than wealth. And I think the other thing is dying. And I, you know, to go back to that question, that I think the dying business is the business that the church should be in. But I don't think that eliminates the building of appropriate and beautiful space.
Yes, back there.
I'm sort of agreeing with what he's saying. At this point, I don't belong to a church, so I can't really identify with that role. But I think that for me as a Christian, as a person, I don't think I have to prove anything to God or to people by selling everything I have and giving to the poor. I think there's a place for both. And I think the most important thing, from what I've discovered, is my heart, if it's right before the Lord, if I'm willing to give up everything, if I'm willing to give up even this or that, then I'm willing to do it. But I don't think I have to do it as an all-out effort just to prove something. I think you can have both. You can have your poor churches that are in the business of feeding the poor, and you can have your churches that are more affluent because they need to reach affluent people, or you know, that kind of thing. So I don't think there's an either or. I just think it's kind of a middle of the road gray area where you just kind of have to decide what the Lord wants you to be doing. And the church is a person, not people in a building, but it's an individual kind of thing.
What are you reaching the affluent people with? That is the question that pops into my mind.
I
kind of thought that I should have retracted what I just said about that. I think it's really hard for a poor person to identify with a rich person and tell them that they need to receive Jesus. Sometimes it works, I'm not saying it doesn't, but I think sometimes with some people, it's easier to reach them if you're on an equal level and you can understand where that person is coming from. And that's sort of, you know, what I was thinking on that line. I think that could work both ways too, though.
Yes.
I don't think it's been said in so many words, but I think what we really need to be feeding people is that gospel of Jesus Christ as being our Savior. And if the stained glass window in the affluent congregation spreads the gospel of Jesus Christ to another affluent person, then that's what God's will is, I believe. And at the same time, with the poor people, a soup kitchen that feeds their stomach, and after you've got their attention, the fact that their stomach has no more gnawing at them, that then they are able to receive the gospel of Jesus Christ also. Then you've reached that person also. You have to work at different levels for different people, different social sizes.
Yes, sir.
I'm troubled by the sense that I get from the conversation that seems to equate loss of wealth with salvation, or disposal of money with going to the cross. That equates in my mind, at least, with doing good works as the way to the cross. And it seems to me that the New Testament message says something about grace being the way to the cross, not the doing of good works or the disposal of material goods. I've just gotten a sense from the whole conversation so far that you seem to be saying that there's some way to get to the cross by doing away with material goods or going out of business as churches or doing some physical act. My understanding of the New Testament is that's not the way to the cross.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think what scripture that speaks of our role as Christians as being middle of the road. It seems to me like it's a very radical statement, and if you don't want to hear it, you can throw it out, but it's there, and I don't see how we can water it down. We may not want to hear it, but I think it's there.
And what is it?
That we feed the hungry. That we take care of the oppressed. That we visit the widow. That we visit the prisoner. It seems to me that's the central focus of Scripture. It repeats itself over and over and over.
Yeah, it seems to me that the central question has to do with idolatry. It seems to have to do with whether affluence per se, by definition, must stand between one and God. And I would say that in support of Brother Rasmussen, that in a certain sense, it's only those who have been affluent and have seen the emptiness of that affluence that can see their need for God, in the same sense that we all must see our own dark sides and our own sinfulness before we understand our need for God's grace. So it seems to me that the central question is one of idolatry. The question that I'm interested in, beyond Brother Rasmussen's thesis, though, is that we seem to stand pat at that point and assume that we don't worship our affluence and that we really do worship God.
Yet there are very few of us who ever really get to the point where the rubber hits the road and do the hard work of doing without something to find out whether in fact that has come between us and our faith. And I think, I'm afraid that most of us would find out that we are awfully sedentary and awfully fattened, and that it would cause us great discomfort to give up part of that. And I think if we found that out, we'd realize that there is a hefty degree of idolatry that stands between us and the radical call to the cross.
Yes.
The calling to be a Christian and to live in faith seems to be interpreted at different economic levels. And the Lutheran Church is historically a middle-class church. We seem to be concerned in this discussion of talking about a different economic group, which I think is very valid. On the other hand, I'm not sure that we're taking a look at needs within our economic strata. In other words, our fellow suburbanites who don't know Christ, you know, and who are starving for a different kind of food. You know, it's easy for us to identify the hungry and the poverty-ridden. They're obvious. I guess I said this because I used to get letters when I was overseas from Sunday school kids saying, what's it like to be a missionary? And I'd write back and I said, well, what's it like to be a missionary in your neighborhood? Because you're doing the same thing there that I'm supposed to be doing here. I was an educational missionary to upper-middle-class expatriate Americans who needed the same kind of services and food, in one sense, that our fellow Americans need here. And I think going to the cross implies putting yourself on the line to your neighbors that are shopping with you at Kmart, as well as the people that are living in the ghettos.
If you ask I think that all of us know, what worries me sometimes is we leave forums and latch on to certain formulations that make it easy for us to dismiss one or the other of the many positions or voices that were heard. And I think it would be too easy, this is a way in the sense to underscore what we just said, I think it would be too easy to walk out and say, well now, some folks seem to think that there's a kind of simple litmus test here for going to the cross, and it may be in this case to kind of go home and actively disband as an organization, or it may be in this case a kind of instance of voting no on the next appropriation for beautifying the church building, or it may be in this case something and so on and so forth. I don't think anybody put forward that kind of list of do's and don'ts in a simple kind of legalistic way to suggest what the way of the cross adds up to. I think that we all know in our minds and hearts what that means, in the sense that we can feel idolatry happening to us as individuals and in congregations when things begin to get in the way of our own ministry and discipleship. I was once on the finance committee of a congregation in California, in my first committee assignment in a parish, and in reviewing the budget, they were a church that had a beautiful sanctuary. Their neighborhood has, as they were putting it, been a changing one. That meant that the insurance bills went up, and they had just voted to install a $750 burglar alarm and security patrol to keep these things safe. When I asked about the budgetary entries for community services, I discovered that they were 1/10 of the total budget to keep people out of the sanctuary through the burglar alarm system. Now it seems to me that these people found themselves in a situation where they had become victimized by their own beauty. Not that beauties themselves are corrupt or corrupting, but in this particular instance it seems to me that survival, in the narrow sense of material survival of what beautified that sanctuary, had become an end that was more important than all sorts of other ends that seemed to me to be much more in keeping with discipleship. So it had begun to inhibit, get in the way of, and everything else, their own mission and ministry. That seems to me to be an instance of idolatry of the sort that Martin was talking about. Now that's not to say that one turns around and says to them, look, what you need to do is, as a kind of standard for all congregations across the board, take up the way of the cross, some act of the sort that each one of the number of us have been experimenting with as we grope for images of what it means to be a disciple. But we all know, I mean, we're not it seems to me, as needful for simple recipes, we can feel from our experiences in our parishes when these things get in the way of being a disciple. And it's precisely when they do, seems to me, that we must be willing to die as an institution, as individuals, if that's where having the mind of Christ leads us. Okay? Seems to me that's the issue. And that's sort of what I'd like people to leave with, a sense of that's the issue. Well, there are other responses to that. I really don't like having the last word. It makes me feel uncomfortable. And
an interesting question. How many people here belong to congregations who are in this building program?
What was the question?
How many people are in the midst of building programs in their parish? Okay. 5 or 6. Expanding. Okay, about 6 to 8 people.
And a questionnaire is, you know, to ask yourself, and it's sort of rhetorically, is what kind of discussion went on in the congregation as to that issue, and along with that was the possibility of another church in another area being built with that same money considered, or was it too easy to find that the majority of people in the congregation kind of slid into the idea that, well, of course there are more people coming and we need more room, and while we're at it, unify and make it more lovely. That's going to be a very hard question for me, I think. And I know it has been for some people close to me. And I think maybe that's an issue close enough to home where we can say, is it possible that we idolize our building?
Yes. I'm currently sitting on 23 building committees. I don't know how many of them have sat on any of them, but the closest thing to purgatory. That is absolutely the truth. It is the building is a thing to be worshipped. In most congregations, I just turned down a job from a Lutheran congregation in Detroit. Pastor gave me the list of the three things that we needed to have in order to have a church. He didn't even say building, he said church. And they were windows, organ, and pews, in that order. And he didn't need himself, he didn't need his people, he didn't need the cross, he didn't need any of that. That's just blatant, out and out idolatry. And I refer to it as edifice complex.
it's very instructive, and I say this out of a realization that our own congregation came to in this regard. It's very instructive to compare the amount of your congregation's budget that goes to any kind of missional concern and the amount that goes to salaries and maintenance of the building. It simply seems to me that we discovered that every time we cut out of the program and missional segments of the budget. The things that were stocked with things were the building maintenance kinds of things. And a decision that I'm kind of proud of our congregation for is that we made a decision to do without a couple of things that give our building kind of a seedy looking appearance, because we don't pay for a full-time janitor and we try to take care of some of that ourselves and a variety of things. But I really think that congregation is more oriented to the mission that I have in mind when I think of the way of the cross, at least, than it was when it was trying to keep up absolutely every appearance. And when it had to cutting out of the things that really had to do with the mission of the church.
Yes.
I think all the churches are going to have to start answering to some of this because of the energy crisis. The high ceilings of the churches and stuff like this, we're going to have to maybe put money into buildings that we really don't want to, that we'd rather spend on mission and that. But because of the energy situation, something's going to have to be done. What's the purpose?